Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group is hosting a panel discussion on the Fair Elections Now Act. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
Good day. This is Allison Hayward. I am an assistant professor of law at George Mason University School of Law, and I am here on behalf of the Federalist Society with two guests to discuss the Fair Elections Now Act. It's an act before Congress that is proving to be quite controversial and quite stimulating to a lot of people. Our guests today are Dr. Craig Holman, who is a government affairs lobbyist at Public Citizen, which is a nonprofit group concerned with political reform, and Bill Maurer, who is at the Institute for Justice in Washington State. The Institute for Justice is a public interest litigation group. Now, gentlemen, we will start first with Craig. Craig, can you give us some background and the basics of the Fair Elections Now Act?
Yes, glad to. First of all, hello, Alice and Bill. Glad to be here. The Fair Elections Now Act has gone through some significant changes through the last few years. It started out as a traditional full public financing model when it was first introduced in Congress, based on the same type of model that you see in Arizona and Maine, where candidates would gather a certain number of small $5 qualifying contributions, then they'd agree to spending ceilings and have the rest of their campaigns entirely paid for by public funds. But it has significantly changed as of the 110th Congress, and for two particular reasons. First of all, we've got new leadership that's taken over the Fair Elections Now Act. It's gone to people like Congressman Larson and Senator Durbin, who have a history of being able to work across the aisles. And so they've tried working to make this a bipartisan legislation. And secondly, we have a different political environment. As we saw in the last election, the small donor phenomenon became something that was a very exciting new development in campaign financing. And so the Larson and Durbin wanted to write that small donor phenomenon into the new public financing proposal. So what we now have with FINA is a public financing system that has no spending ceilings. It allows for unlimited small donations of $100 or less. What happens is, on the House side, for instance, a candidate would demonstrate their viability for public financing by gathering about 1,500 small contributions ranging between $5 and $100, and gathering at least $50,000 total in those qualifying contributions. Once they qualified, they would receive a substantial public financing grant, roughly of about $350,000 in the primary and $540,000 in the general election. And then they would continue raising small contributions of $100 or less, and those small contributions would be matched at a 4-to-1 ratio, 4 public dollars for each $1 in private contributions. The public financing and the House side would finally cap out at about $2.8 million if candidates wanted to keep on raising small contributions and actually reach that point, which I wouldn't expect most candidates to go to. And then after the public financing is exhausted of $2.8 million, the candidates can continue indefinitely raising small contributions throughout the course of the campaign. So it's a very different type of model. It's a model that emphasizes small donors and has no spending ceilings.
Okay, thank you very much, Craig. So, Bill, small donor revolution sounds great. What's the problem with this legislation?
Well, the problem, Allison, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and Craig about this important topic, but the problem with the bill itself is actually more of a theoretical problem and not necessarily with this version of the bill. Proponents of these kinds of systems call them systems of public financing, and that, I think, sums up the problem right there. We already have public financing of campaigns in this country. The people who donate to campaigns right now are members of the public, and they're expressing themselves, and they're engaging in free speech and free association when they engage in political activity, including the donations to campaigns, candidates, and causes in which they believe. What we're talking about here is not publicly financed candidate campaigns, but campaigns where the public or certain members of the public are forced to finance campaigns, oftentimes campaigns of people with whom they disagree. The idea, if you actually read the bills, they express in them that the current system undermines democracy. Having people engaging in free association by contributing to candidates of their choosing, I don't think undermines democracy. I think forcing people to support the campaigns of people that they may not agree with is what would actually undermine democracy. And I think also there's a theoretical problem from the very beginning, in addition to the idea that somehow donors are not the public. The idea is that we have to pay politicians or candidates or shower them with money preemptively so that they won't succumb to the temptation of taking money for less than ethical reasons in the future. Suggests that somehow that we can't expect our elected officials to be honest, and we can't expect them to be ethical, and that we have to stop them before they're corrupt again. I think that the problem with one of the problems with laws like these is that they shift the responsibility for acting for politicians and elected officials acting ethically and straightforwardly in the interests of their constituents. It shifts the responsibility from the politicians themselves onto the burdens and the backs of the American citizenry, who have to find that their ability to engage in free association and free speech have to be limited so that politicians won't do the wrong thing. So those are some of the basic theoretical problems I see with laws like these.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Now, I'd like to pose a question that's been on my mind to both of you. I'll start first with Craig. One of the campaign finance phenomena that people generally, commentators and other people out there are troubled by is the increase and predominance in some races of outside groups and independent activity. Now, we've talked about Fair Elections Now Act and how it affects the relationship between a candidate and donors. But what effect does it have on the activities of outside groups? Craig, you go first.
Sure. The Fair Elections Now Act really doesn't address outside groups. It provides no additional matching funds to try to match expenditures by outside groups. What it does is it provides robust public financing to qualified candidates so that they can get their message out, no matter what outside groups are doing. You know, when we're talking about the maximum amount of public funds just for a House candidate of $2.8 million, I mean, that's more than what nearly any congressional candidate currently spends. And they can continue raising funds indefinitely after that if they want to. So we in drafting the Fair Elections Now Act, we just felt it wasn't necessary to have to address outside groups, because we are providing enough campaign funds so that any candidate can get their message across.
Okay, Craig. Now, Bill, for your part, one of your big theoretical complaints about the Fair Elections Now Act is the impediment it places on the political activity of donors and their right to associate. Wouldn't a donor's ability to become part of one of these outside groups and one of those efforts kind of solve that problem for you?
Well, the fact that it doesn't restrict independent expenditures, I guess, is a benefit of this version of the law, as opposed to some of the state versions that we've seen, for instance, in Arizona, Connecticut, and Maine. And donors can participate by contributing to independent expenditures groups or independent groups or PACs if they so desire. The problem with that consideration, of course, is that the independent expenditure groups may be pushing a line of argument with which the donor does not agree entirely, and they may agree entirely with the speech of the political candidate to whom they wish to donate. So it's sort of cutting off an avenue for political association and being able to say, well, there's a somewhat acceptable alternative out there. Isn't that enough? I don't think qualifies for a good a reason to shut off a particular or preferred avenue of political association that the donor would like to engage in.
Okay. Now, since this is a Federal Society podcast, I'd be remiss in not bringing up a recent court decision that we should be probably acknowledging. A federal judge in Connecticut ruled that state's clean money system was unconstitutional because of the burdens it placed on minor party candidates or the disproportionate benefits it gave major party candidates. Now, are there implications in that case for this act? I'll start with you, Bill.
I don't see the same problems with the Connecticut Act that are in the Fair Elections Now Act. The Connecticut Act had two aspects of it that led the district court to strike it down. One was that it did disproportionately impact small parties in a very discriminatory way. The other aspect of it was it contained something which are referred to in the states as trigger funds, which is that if a privately financed candidate exceeds the amount of money that the public or the government provides to the publicly financed candidate, the government will match the privately financed candidate's excess above that amount directly to the publicly financed candidate, so that there's sort of a one-to-one match for every time that the privately financed candidate speaks, the publicly financed candidate benefits. That aspect of the law, which had been in earlier versions, as Craig had mentioned, is not present in this area in this version of the bill. That doesn't mean that there aren't constitutional problems in these two bills. It just means that those aren't the same problems that were in the Connecticut and Arizona bills.
And if I could add a little bit
on
that.
Yes, please do, Craig.
Well, first of all, the Connecticut public financing system I do consider an excellent model, and even the judge in this case has agreed to allow the public financing system to continue operating until after an appeal is heard. So it is continuing. But when it comes to the Fair Elections Now Act, there were some signs that especially the new Supreme Court, might have problems with such things as the trigger provision or the rescue funds, as well as making sure to screen out unqualified candidates. And as a result, when we were drafting the Fair Elections Now Act, we took those into consideration, namely the Davis versus FEC court case.
Yeah, Craig, why don't you elaborate a little bit so our listeners are up to speed on what Davis was about.
Sure. The Davis decision was a Supreme Court decision just a little while ago that threw out the Millionaire's Amendment of the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act, or the McCain-Feingold Law. And that was a provision that allowed contribution limits to increase for candidates who are being challenged by self-funded candidates. The court ruled that could have a chilling effect on self-funded candidates because there is a special benefit given to one candidate over the other. So we decided to avoid providing any kind of special benefits to qualified candidates and to avoid things like matching expenditures by outside groups And that's why we did away with the spending ceilings and the additional matching funds. We just provide matching funds to all qualified candidates until the public funding runs out.
Okay, very good. Now, I guess I want to sort of turn the focus of this a little bit from sort of what the law does and how it works to why we think it's an improvement to the extent you do, Craig, over the existing system. I mean, first of all, we all understand that members of Congress enjoy, you know, incumbent members of Congress enjoy astronomical reelection rates. A lot of the impetus behind, at least the rhetoric in the Fair Elections Now Act, is that members spend too much time raising money and need to be spending more time doing the important work of the nation. But how is it that with these astronomical reelection rates, incumbent congressmen find themselves spending all this time raising money? Why are they doing it if they're not concerned about reelection? What's pushing the problem that makes this a sensible solution?
There's several elements as to why a public financing system is very worthwhile. And, you know, what Bill refers to as problems with the public financing systems, I find as it to be the very benefits of it. First of all, when we're talking about, you know, donors in a privately financed system, we're talking about a fraction of 1% of Americans have ever made a campaign contribution to any candidate or political party. And that fraction of 1% then becomes the base upon which candidates have to focus and rely on for their campaign financing. And so by setting up a public financing system, we're broadening the base to be the general public as opposed to a small fraction of the citizens. And, you know, secondly, when there is that small fraction of citizens going on, providing all the campaign money, there does arise the problem of indebtedness for the candidates to those who are the contributors. And, you know, it's important if we're going to have good, high-quality elections and a government that's not accountable just to their a small group of financiers to set up a broadly based finance system, and that's public financing. And third, which you were bringing up, Allison, is candidates tend to like this public financing system because currently they really spend, one estimate by some political scientists at the University of Maryland is roughly about 33% of their campaign time dialing for dollars and raising funds. And with a good public financing system such as FINA, we expect that amount of time spent fundraising to actually drop down to about 5% to 8% of a candidate's time. So really, all around, the public financing system improves the quality of elections.
Bill, I would take it you would have a different view on that. What is the problem that this legislation will solve?
Well, let me give you a little background, actually. One of the reasons why I'm familiar with this issue is that I'm lead counsel in a challenge to Arizona's system of public financing, which Craig had mentioned is somewhat different and I think more constitutionally problematic than the Fair Elections Now Act, not saying that FINA is entirely without constitutional problems, but Arizona's, I think, is clearly far more problematic from a free speech and free association standard. And back when system in Arizona, which is called Clean Elections, was proposed in 1998, we heard many of these same promises, and the promises that are very similar to the ones that are in the introduction to both of the versions of the Fair Elections Now Act currently before Congress. And the promises were that that we would get cleaner campaigns, we would have a legislature that was more in touch with the people, there would be renewed confidence in the political process, and perhaps even a decrease in government spending. And instead, what people have gotten in Arizona since clean elections were implemented starting in 2000 up through 2008, is some of the dirtiest campaigns on record, because as politicians no longer needed to modify or moderate their speech in order to appeal to a broad range of donors or potential donors, they got a system that is highly complex, and to the point where a majority of Arizonans in 2006 didn't even know the system existed, and to the extent that they did know about it, they didn't understand how it worked. The incumbency reelection rates are very similar to what they were prior to the enactment of the law. And perhaps most problematic is that the legislature in Arizona is now comprised of the hard left and the hard right, as politicians no longer have to appeal to the moderate middle in order to raise sufficient money to be able to conduct a competitive campaign. And as for the claim that this claim is also repeated in the versions of the Fair Election Now Act Congress is currently considering, as to the claim that it would reduce spending because there'd be less special interest money going out. Arizona currently has one of the nation's largest budget deficits, and in the past year was largely paralyzed during budget negotiations, even to the point where they were considering shutting down the government for part of the time. What we have seen in Arizona as a result, the only empirical result that we've seen has been what a proponent of the system has described as a marginal increase in competition. And it's not clear to me that this marginal increase is actually attributable to clean elections and not to not just to the term limits law that was implemented at the same time. So I think that, you know, in terms of the promises that are made, they are largely unproven to the extent that they are provable at all, and that the promises that are made in the Fair Elections Now Act are oftentimes simply incorrect and inconsistent with the experience in the state. So, you know, a lot of proponents of the system say that clean elections or fair elections are a proven, workable system. The system operates. It doesn't work. If by work you mean that it meets the goals of the people who are pushing it.
Okay. Now, Craig, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Bill has just said, and then I have another question for you. But first of all, Craig, what does the Arizona experience have to say about, you know, the likelihood that the Fair Elections Now Act will actually accomplish any good reform?
Well, actually, the Arizona experience is reflective of some of the accomplishments that we see in a public financing system. First of all, I want to emphasize public financing programs, their objective is not to reduce spending in campaigns, and it certainly isn't designed to influence the messages or, you know, what type of ideology or party gets represented by the candidates. The objectives, first of all, are to increase the choices available to voters by increasing the competitiveness of who's running for office, and also enabling even those who normally wouldn't raise large amounts of funds to be able to get their messages out. And, you know, there's quite a bit of political science research that backs up the claim that this is exactly what public financing programs succeeded doing. One study that was put together by the Brennan Center surveyed all state elections from 1980 through 2006, and it found that campaign finance systems that had fairly low contribution limits of $500 or lower were significantly more competitive than states that had very high contribution limits, and that states that had public financing were also significantly more competitive. More candidates ran, there were more choices for voters. That's the real objective of a public financing program.
Okay. Now, Craig, isn't there also a sort of a deeper danger that we haven't really talked about yet, which is the moral hazard of giving Congress essentially the keys to campaign finance, even more than we do already with the Federal Election Campaign Act and the Bipartisan Reform Act? Maybe this version of the Fair Elections Now Act seems even-handed and structurally sound, But the precedent of giving congressional incumbents the power to change the system or to amend this act in the future in their own pursuit of incumbent protection, I mean, it's the moral hazard problem. Where do you stand on that?
The tough achievements when it comes to trying to deal with Congress is to get Congress to adopt a public financing program in the first place, because a public financing system does not play in the favor of incumbents and Congress itself. It provides and guarantees a good, robust budget for competitors to these incumbents. So I'm not worried about Congress trying to rig the public financing system. We'd never let them do it. And I couldn't even imagine a way in which any court would allow a rigged public financing system to exist. The worry is trying to get this public financing program through Congress, first of all. And that's got to be our objective at this point.
Bill, do you have any concerns about this moral hazard problem?
Well, I think what are there's two things that we need to consider in that aspect. One is that if you actually look at the words of the bill, or both bills that are before Congress right now, they talk about reducing the disproportionate and unfair influence of people on the political process, or in reducing the problem of equal access. I think the U.S. Supreme Court was quite clear, and our American traditions are quite clear, that it is not the job of the government to say that someone's political activities or influence are disproportionate or unfair, and they need to be more equal. The government is not a sound engineer who gets to turn up certain people's voices and turn down others. And the reason for that is, I think, the moral hazard that you're talking about, Allison, which is that when you give the government the power to reduce undue or disproportionate influence, what do those terms mean? Well, they're oftentimes going to mean whatever the people in power disagree with that they believe is undue or disproportionate. I fear giving Congress the ability to turn down people's voices or turn up people's voices will mean that Congress will simply be in the job, doing the job of turning down the voices with which they disagree.
Okay, Craig. In wrapping up, you talked about the difficulty that Congress has had in the past with trying to pass a public funding bill. What's going to happen in this session?
This legislation this year is a very real bill pending before Congress. You know, I've always supported public financing, for as long as I've been with Public Citizen, and so has Public Citizen, and we've endorsed public financing bills, but have never really worked very hard on them because they just weren't politically realistic to get through Congress in earlier years. Ever since the 110th Congress, and especially this Congress, the 111th Congress, it's all changed. The dynamics is very different. I mean, this time we have some dynamic leaders that are stepping up to the plate, pushing this bill, with Larson and Walter Jones on the House side, and Durbin, and what we had as a bipartisan bill, Arlen Specter, on the Senate side. It's no longer bipartisan on the Senate side, but it still is bipartisan on the House side.
And let's explain, in case there's any confusion, that's not because Arlen Specter has abandoned his support. It's because Arlen Specter has changed his party affiliation.
That's right. Arlen Specter has changed his party affiliation. But we are expecting to get some Republican support on the Senate side as well. Because this is a different type of bill and a different type of leadership pushing the bill, we've been able to get, so far, 77 co-sponsors on the House side, and they're not just Democratic liberals who used to be the people who would sign on to this bill. This time, we're getting a few Republicans, but we're also getting Blue Dog Democrats, Moderate Democrats, the New Democrats, Congressional Black Caucus, Congressional Hispanic Caucus. I mean, literally, it's a broad base of support that we're finding lagging on the House side so far. And, you know, I expect to find the same type of support on the Senate side once we start pursuing it there. So this legislation, this time around, is very real. It's something that I am expecting to pass through Congress in the 111th session.
Okay. And, Bill, it looks like it may happen. What are your thoughts on what we can expect as a result?
I agree with Craig that the likelihood of passage in this Congress is much higher than it has been in the past, and that for that reason we need to do a more systemic analysis of what this bill does and why it's there and what are some of the problems with it. I think there's basically two basic problems with this, and indeed with a lot of campaign finance laws, is that campaign finance laws tend to treat a symptom, which is corruption, instead of the disease itself, which is a government that is too big and quite frankly does too much. The problem is not that the government's handing out benefits to the wrong people; it's that it's handing out benefits at all. And when you have the government acting beyond its constitutional boundaries, people are always going to try and influence the direction of the benefits and burdens to ensure that they get the benefits and their opposition or their competitors get the burdens. But ultimately, I think we need to look at the fact that at a time when Americans are cutting back and when deficits are exploding, spending the public's money so that politicians and candidates can get or keep a job just doesn't seem like a good expenditure of resources. Americans shouldn't be in the business of subsidizing yet another group of elites who believe that their role is so essential that they're essentially too big to fail or too important to fail.
All right. Well, thanks again to Craig Holman from Public Citizen and Bill Maurer from the Institute for Justice in Washington State. This is Professor Allison Hayward from George Mason Law School. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.